Now it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We've all probably shared a meal with a picky eater before. Maybe it was one of your kids who didn't want to eat the veggies. Maybe it was a friend who sticks to what they like. Maybe it's you sometimes. There's no shame in being a picky eater. Everybody has different experiences with food. There's some evidence our food preferences could be linked to our genes, even. Our next guest is here to help us cook for the picky eaters in our lives and find new ways to prepare foods that we think we don't like. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you cook for picky eaters in your life? Have you found tricks to mask the flavor of some foods or sneak things into a dish? Are there things that you used to not like, but you found a way to like them? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Deb Perlman is creator of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen. She's the author of three cookbooks. The latest is called Smitten Kitchen Keepers, New Classics for Your Forever Files. She used to write guest articles, by the way, for Bon Appetit magazine called Picky Eaters Club. Deb, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, I think Deb Perlman, if she cooks a meal, everybody's going to like it. Nobody's going to be picky about this, but the pickiness is coming from inside the house, Deb. I guess your kids sometimes are picky, right?
It's like you knew. yeah, the picky eaters are inside the house. I actually feel like, you know, a recipe writer, a cookbook author that has really picky kids that don't want to eat any of her food, it's like hubris. Like, I had these children coming. I created them. I need them so they can keep me balanced.
What kinds of foods do you find you encounter prime pickiness on for your kids in particular?
Oh boy! I mean, where does one start? It could be. I mean, I guess spice is the obvious thing, which is really a bummer because, although that's changing though, because my son is now, he's turning 14, he's going into high school, and he definitely will put some hot sauce on his food. But it took a bunch of years, so I think they'll get there. But my younger one, if it has spice, if it's like, I don't know. I'm making eggplant parmesan tonight, and I feel like she's definitely not going to touch it, even though she likes all these flavors. You know, even if she's a little skeptical of eggplant. So it should be fun. I can keep you posted on how it goes, but I can probably guess.
And I've seen you in interviews, Deb, sometimes say that you're a closet picky eater for some things yourself.
I am such a closet picky eater. I don't know if it's just me or is it other people who do the food thing, but like, I wonder if in some way we're driven to it because we want things to be a certain way and they're not. I mean, that's kind of where you start. So I didn't really like eggplant parmesan growing up, but I didn't really understand like the breaded soggy thing. But then I started making it my own way and now I love it. So that's kind of, you know, where it comes from. And that's where it goes, I think, where you might start by thinking you don't like things and then you, you know, can get to the bottom of it by cooking through them.
Well, and that's, for me, eggplant is one of those foods. I never, like, hated it. I never liked it. I would never eat it by choice. If somebody made it, fine, I'll eat it. And then I started having it, you know, people would make it at State Fair and stuff, fry it up with some lemon and a little Parmesan. Mm. And that was, like, my gateway for eggplant. Mm-hmm. Now I like it all kinds of ways. Is that sometimes the key to bringing people into a new food, finding that one way they like it and then branching out from there?
Absolutely. And you have no idea when it's going to happen or where. So my advice would be, if you have picky eaters like coming from inside your house, the best thing you can do is try to keep making what you've always made and what you're craving, because you have no idea when it's going to be that they're going to like pick up a lamb chop off the table and go to town on it. And you won't find out if you just make the boring food that they say they like every day.
Now, there have been whole cookbooks, Deb, out there on the market that are basically like, yeah, trick your family into eating these foods that are good for them, even though they don't like them. And, you know, how to disguise vegetables in cake or whatever. What do you think about that notion?
I'm generally opposed. I kind of feel like if I'm sticking like spinach in a brownie, I'm probably teaching the kids to hate both spinach and brownies, which seems like a crime in and of itself. I think that people will come around to it eventually, but they might just need to try it a few ways. I also think, I don't know, I've never been able to articulate it well, but I feel like there's this whole other psychology at home where when you come home, you want your mom or your dad to make the food the way you like it. And the disappointment is less that the food isn't what you want, but more that the people who are supposed to cater to your every whim and beck and call didn't do it. I just feel like it's just a theory, but I just think it comes out more in the safety of our own home. For example, let's say you go home every year for Thanksgiving and your mom always makes turkey your favorite way and you love the way she makes turkey. And one year you come home and she's made it a completely different way. Would you not feel a little affronted? You knew I liked it this way and you made it this other way. I sometimes feel like that's what I'm dealing with at the dinner table. This betrayal.
It's Food Friday, and we're talking to Deb Perlman from the cooking site Smitten Kitchen, author of books of the same title. We're talking about picky eating, ways to cook to overcome pickiness amongst our kids, even amongst ourselves. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to admit, are you now or have you ever been a picky eater yourself? Did you find ways to overcome it and try new stuff that you didn't think you liked originally? Have you dealt with this with your own kids at home? Have you found ways to get them to try that new thing? Maybe even eventually to like that new thing. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. And we got a note from our producer, Rochelle, who says, I'd love to hear about olives. I really want to be a person who loves olives. I try out once a year. Probably an urban myth that if you try them you like 17 times, you'll like them. Okay, no, so this, I bring this up, Deb, because this was me. I used to hate olives. Mm-hmm. I had some housemates who liked some green olives on pizza with other good stuff. I ate it that way. Again, this was my gateway into olives. Now I love them. I'll just snack on olives of various shapes and sizes. Do you have thoughts on how somebody like Rochelle, for some reason, wants to acquire an olive taste, how she could do it?
You know, that's a tricky one because I have members of my family, people I know, and they just don't like it. I guess my question is it the brininess? Like, do you also dislike pickles or is it olives in particular? Because I don't think I thought I was an olive person growing up, and I still like my stomach actually turns by the black canned ones. I just don't like them. There's something squishy about them. I'm sorry. I should speak more maturely. I don't mean to yuck anyone's yum. But I love those dark green ones that are a little, they almost taste more like vegetables to me. And I love, you know, there's different ones. And I like a good Kalamata one. And I also, there are these little black cured ones. They go by a couple different names. I think they're like Gaeta olives. And I think they're incredibly salty. But you mince them up and they make a pasta sauce just pop off. So I think definitely trying a bunch of different varieties. Mm. Can help, but I also think it's okay. Like, or maybe sometimes it becomes something like I have this chicken that I love to make with olives and lemon and garlic and thyme, and it comes together so well. So sometimes the gateway is just it being in a dish that you love and it carries it, and you can kind of see where what it does there.
Awesome. It's also okay to just not like olives, I think. I like
it's
them
okay.
Now, though.
You guys, I don't like beets, okay? So it's fine. It's just, it's never going to happen. It's okay. I've made peace with it. I don't know if the internet has. I'm going to get some emails.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Cassie is with us in Lake Mills. Cassie, hi.
Hi. I just have a really quick story. I have two girls, and they're grown now. But they were always very picky eaters. And I did tend to make excuses when there were other people around and say, oh, well, they're girls. They eat like birds. And I would feed them really what they like. But one time, I will never forget this, my one daughter would not touch tomatoes, didn't like anything with tomatoes. She would pick them out of any salad or anything. And we were at my dad and his wife's house, and she made BLTs. It was a hot summer day, and big chunks, thick slices of tomatoes. And if Brianna didn't just eat those sandwiches, I think she had two. So later I asked her, I said, well, what is with you? You don't like tomatoes. I can't believe you ate that. Told Grace how wonderful it was. And she said, well, I didn't want to be rude. And actually, it was so good.
So I guess the big question, Cassie, is then did she eat tomatoes henceforth?
Yeah. Oh, she eats spaghetti, all kinds of pasta dishes with tomatoes. Yep. Yep, all the time.
Cassie, thanks for the call. Deb, I wonder if the secret there was the B. Like, can you make any food better with a little bacon on top of it?
I mean, I generally feel that this is a time-honored tradition. You can put some bacon in a broccoli salad. You can put bacon on your green beans, and suddenly everyone's a green bean fan. It definitely works. It's salt. And if you don't eat bacon, I mean, you could – I love putting, like, crushed salted pistachios. There are other things. I'd say olives, but I know they're very contentious, that you can do to add that kind of pop that makes it a little more exciting.
Thanks a lot for that call. Oh, and speaking of kids, and Deb, you mentioned those beets that you don't like. In my household, My kids are growing up now too, but dad was the only one who liked to eat beets. Everybody else hated them, but it kind of helped with other foods. Cause like, if they weren't sure about something, it was like, well, hey, at least it's not beets, right? Can we set up one food as the fall guy to promote other ones? Or is that just my strategy? I don't know.
I feel like I do a lot of negotiating. I feel like I do a lot of like, please just try a bite. You don't have to like, if you were actually to tune into my table at dinner time, you might hear me saying, could I get you to sniff it? Would you lick the fork that the food used to be on? Parenting is all about dignity.
Yeah. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Deb Pearlman of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen, author of the Smitten Kitchen series of books, talking about cooking for picky eaters and how to make the foods we don't like taste good, maybe acquire some taste. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to enjoy foods that you didn't used to like? What worked for you? Do you or have you ever cooked for picky eaters, spouses, children, friends, you name it? Did you find ways to overcome that pickiness? Join in at 800-642-1234. Or was the solution just to make them cook for themselves? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the Friday News Roundup with a look at the latest from the devastating wildfire in Hawaii to the big indictments in Georgia. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, for the first time, a woman was set to join the highest group of American military leaders this week. Admiral Lisa Franchetti was nominated to replace Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Mike Gilday and join the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Her nomination, though, is one of more than 300 position changes held in limbo by a standoff between the Biden administration and Department of Defense, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, and Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville from Alabama. That number comes from data obtained and verified by the Washington Post. Tuberville in February objected to moving forward with what is normally a bipartisan procedure to approve numerous military confirmations and promotions all at once. That was in response to the Pentagon's shift in policy following last year's Dobbs Supreme Court decision to provide paid leave and reimburse travel expenses incurred by service members who cross state lines for legal abortion care. Here's Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin speaking on Monday.
Because of this blanket hold, starting today, for the first time in the history of the Department of Defense, three of our military services are operating without Senate-confirmed leaders. This is unprecedented, it is unnecessary, and it is unsafe. And this sweeping hold is undermining America's military readiness. It's hindering our ability to retain our very best officers. And it is upending the lives of far too many American military families.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this story since February? What are your thoughts on it? Do you think the Pentagon made the right move changing its policy? What do you think of Senator Tuberville's decision to hold up votes because of this policy? If you are or a family member is in the military, what do you think about all of this? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Peter Fever is a professor of political science at Duke University, director of the Duke Program in American Grand Strategy, and professor in the Sanford School of Public Policy. He's the author of a new book called Thanks for Your Service, The Causes and Consequences of Public Confidence in the U.S. Military. Peter, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the impact of all of this, let's start with the policy dispute at the center of this. You mentioned to our producer, you think there's a legitimate policy discussion to be had about this Pentagon policy to reimburse travel for service members seeking abortion.
Yes, I do think that reasonable people can differ on the underlying policy disagreement that drove Senator Tuberville to take pretty drastic action. What the DOD did was in response to the new world that we live in under Dobbs. So when Roe v. Wade, abortion care was the same across all states. And when that was changed by the Supreme Court under the Dobbs decision, states could have different abortion policies. That meant that a military person who was assigned to be in the state, didn't have a choice about what state they'd be in, might find themselves with very different healthcare options just by virtue of different actions by the state. When the in response to that, the Department of Defense made the decision that said they would cover the costs for a person to travel to another state to seek whatever healthcare options they wanted that would be legal in those other states. Here's the rub. By doing so, that upended a implicit sort of agreement between pro-life and pro-choice activists under the Roe v. Wade era that said we won't use taxpayer dollars to fund abortions. Of course, that was a compromise struck under the Roe era, and they just didn't forge a new compromise under Dobbs. And when the Department of Defense took this action, it kind of forced the issue. Senator Tuberville responded in a very dramatic way. And while there's precedent for putting holds on large numbers of officers, there's no precedent for something this sweeping, lasting this long, that we are in uncharted territory today.
People might look at this and say, well, they can have interim people in all of these positions. We'll look at some of the affected positions in a bit. But is this just a bureaucratic distinction? All the work is getting done, so not a big deal?
No, it's much more serious than that. For one thing, the Senate demands that people who have been nominated but not confirmed demands that they do not take any action that would presume upon Senate confirmation. So they are frozen. The actings are more junior officers who are temporarily acting in the place of the one more senior who is frozen. However, several of the actings were the ones nominated to take over the higher position. So, for instance, the chief of staff of the Army is someone who had been vice chief. And so he is tapped to be the acting chief. But because of the Senate rule, he's not allowed to take action that would presume he would be confirmed as chief. So he's acting chief, but he doesn't have the full authority that an acting chief would have. And an acting chief doesn't have the full authority and scope of action that a confirmed chief has. So there's a lot of uncertainty that's rippling through the ranks just within the U.S. military. But then if you think about how our senior military in many of these positions have a key role of interacting with our allies and partners and engaging with our adversaries, you know, in sitting across the table, perhaps, and talking to them on tough issues. But if they're acting and not confirmed, then they're limited in what they can say and do. And so it's freezing the activities of our allies and partners, and it's giving a big advantage to our adversaries. So it may seem like it's a bureaucratic interruption. And if this had happened for just, you know, a week or two, that's all it would have been. But now that we're into this going on for many months and we've reached 300, this is a deep blow to military readiness.
Do you have particular concerns with people in the Asian region who might be dealing with, say, China?
Well, if you look, you know, people have asked me, what are the most serious ones? Well, of course, everyone would say the top names, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who's frozen right now. President Biden nominated C.Q. Brown. By all expectations, the Senate will confirm him if the hold were lifted. So he is frozen. Several of the chiefs of staff of the services are frozen. Those have big symbolic as well as material consequences. But if you look more deeply at just the Indo-PACOM theater, there's a lot of warfighting admirals and generals who are sort of poised to take policy and advance it and advance the preparedness of our forces in the Indo-PACOM theater, which, of course, is where we face our pacing challenge in China. They aren't able to act. And so this is a gift to China, a gift that keeps giving every day by putting us on our hind legs and giving an advantage to them. The number of frozen warfighters in the Indo-PACOM theater.
Talking to Peter Fever from Duke University, looking at this block on key appointments and promotions in the U.S. military over a policy dispute about compensation from the military for travel expenses related to abortion. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, reactions, and questions. Let's bring on a caller now. Rod is with us in Madison. Rod, hi. Are you there, Rod?
Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear. Yep, what did you want to bring up?
Yes, sir. I'm not opinionated either way, but I am just taking the comment by the Secretary of Defense a little bit, in my opinion. I felt out of line because the senator, in my opinion, and this is what I would like to comment of your guest, they, by definition, they are acting on the wish and the will of their constituents. So to assume that this is just primarily politically motivated and not looking at what prompted that action. And the other thing is the notion that these chiefs will have issue with career. I mean, where else would they go to be hired to work? So I don't understand this comment, the Secretary of Defense, that this is their career issue. So I'm going to stop talking and listen. Thank you very much for letting me talk here.
Rod, thanks for the call. Peter, Rod's first point saying, you know, this is a political dispute, questioning, I think, the tactics here. Do you see maybe a more productive way to have this legitimate, as you say, policy dispute without this embargo?
Well, there's no question that this has become a political football now. I think it has been working for Senator Tuberville. In a political sense, he has gone from being an obscure junior senator to being the subject of multiple news stories, including Wisconsin Public Radio. So he's gained in stature. As a consequence, he's been able to raise a lot of do a lot of fundraising off this issue. And for one wing of the sort of the MAGA Rhino establishment, he's celebrated. So it's working narrowly in a narrow political sense for him. Whether it's in fact popular among his constituents in Alabama, I think the polling data suggests that it depends very much on how you frame the question to the Alabama voters as to whether they support this or not. But it is, you know, it is working for him politically. Now, what the caller also suggested was that these generals and admirals have nowhere to go, so they'll just wait it out and we won't lose anyone. Unfortunately, that's just not the case. All of these senior military leaders have many good options on the outside. And while I'm not so much worried about losing the ones who have been nominated and are frozen, I think they will stay. I think where we'll see the drain is in the next level down. And think about all the family conversations around the kitchen table as the spouses are saying, should we stay in for another 3-4 years and try to get that next promotion? And then they are looking at this happening, and this tilts the internal calculation towards, you know, let's leave. Why should we subject our family to another move, to all the disruptions, only to find ourselves frozen in place? And that, let me just make one further point about this. We're not just freezing 300 general and flag officers. We're freezing thousands of family members who also can't move, don't know whether they're going to go to high school here or whether they'll never get confirmed, and so they have to go to high school there, whether the spouse should try to get a job here or there. All of those decisions are on hold. So the impact is rippling through the community and I think reaching down into lower ranks. And I worry about its impact on retention going forward.
Thanks for that call, Rod. We're talking to Peter Fever, political science professor at Duke University, looking at this ongoing standoff between a Republican senator and the U.S. military over its policy supporting service members who want to seek abortion care in states where it's still legal to do so, and a block on many key promotions and appointments in the military. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? How would you like to see this all resolved? Are you a member of the military or a family member or a former military member? What does this look like to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Peter Fever, professor of political science at Duke University, looking at stalled leadership confirmations and promotions across the branches of the U.S. military, how they're affecting national defense. Go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Brenda is with us in Menominee. Brenda, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to ask about?
I just want to know, how is it that one senator has the power to hold up all these confirmations?
Great question, Brenda. Peter, why is it that it works this way?
So this has to do with the arcane rules of the Senate, and it's a courtesy. The Senate could eliminate this if they chose, but that would be considered something like a nuclear option. It would destroy the powers of every senator, and so the Senate is unwilling to do that because every senator has used holds at some point or other to influence their negotiations with the administration. In that extent, this is not unusual. It's not unusual for a senator to squeeze the administration through the hold process in order to get some concession. What's unusual is the scope and the length of this one. Now, the way it works, the Senate could force through votes on the nominations, but they'd have to do them one at a time. And that would take a tremendous amount of floor time. Indeed, to get through all 300 now, it'd probably take all of the remaining floor time that the Senate has in this session. And so it's just not workable. Some people expected, I expected, that Senator Schumer, who's the leader of the Senate, would have kept senators in D.C. during August. So not give them a recess and just force them to go through the onerous process of voting one by one by one, at least for some of the more senior names. And doing so would have put pressure on Senator Tuberville because it would have made 99 other senators mad that they were missing their chance to go back and campaign in the district. They were forced to go through what is, scut work from the Senate's point of view. Senator Schumer opted not to do that. And that was a missed opportunity, I think, to put pressure and maybe change the calculation within the Republican caucus as to whether to continue to support Senator Tuberville.
Brenda, thanks a lot for that call. Chris joins us now in Eau Claire. Chris, what did you want to bring up?
It's kind of more of a comment. I'm a former enlisted member of the military, the Air Force, and it boggles my mind that a senator would want to inhibit our foreign protection and against for adversaries, and then just beat some domestic policy to a dead horse when you can easily, at least in my mind, separate those two things. Domestic issues can be dealt with long term, but you got to do what you got to do to make sure that the military is ready to go at any point in time. So that's just my comment.
Chris, thanks for the call. Peter, what do you think?
Well, one of the questions that's kept this dispute going for so long is that we don't know what Senator Tuberville would accept as a compromise. So what he has said is the only deal he'll accept is if DOD completely reverses course and surrenders, basically, to his view. He had a chance to have a vote on the floor, a vote in the Senate on the policy issue and he could have created a law that would have forced DOD to accept his preferred policy. That's within the power of Congress to do. But Senator Tuberville chose not to do that. He's trying to force the DOD just to back down. And that raises the question, maybe Senator Tuberville doesn't really have his own idea of how to get out of this. I think he may be stuck in the same dead end that the we all are stuck in, and he doesn't know a way out. Because if the only thing he's proposing is that DOD completely surrender to his perspective, well, the DOD is not going to do that. President Biden has said he's not going to do that. Secretary Austin has said they're not going to do that. And so what is the compromise that Senator Tuberville would accept? Hard to see at this stage.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Peter Fever from Duke University about this block on about 300 plus now key appointments in the U.S. military. Back to your calls. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Hi. Under the previous administration, there was a discussion about moving the Space Force Command from Colorado to Alabama. And now under the current administration, that has been tabled indefinitely, and the Space Force Command was said to be staying in Colorado. Now, Senator Tuberville seems to have come out with this kind of drastic policy of, you know, blocking these confirmations. In my view, almost retaliatory move to kind of force maybe some more discussion around the move of the Space Command.
Chris, thanks for the call. I think the timing here, though, is the blockade, the Tuberville's blockade of these appointments started months ago, I think, and that Space Command decision became public at the end of July. So there have been some accusations that the Biden administration was retaliating over this. What do you think of all that, Peter?
Well, a lot of people thought that there might be a deal that you know, in March, April timeframe, before this thing became the juggernaut for fundraising that it has become, before it became elevated to such a high culture war level, that maybe what Senator Tuberville really wanted was to get the headquarters moved to Alabama. There was a reasonable argument to move it to Alabama, and that some members actually of the Biden administration actually supported that, while the majority, at least the president anyway, decided to go the other way. The problem is, now that we've reached this stage of the standoff, I think it's very unlikely that the Biden administration would reverse course on the Space Force headquarters decision. And so that deal, which may have been available in March, April, no longer available. And this really speaks to the larger issue here. We've got to stop making the military combatants in our culture wars. There's a legitimate debate about what is the appropriate abortion care policy. Reasonable people can debate how to handle that. But what we've done now is we're targeting the uniformed military and making them combatants in that culture war. We got to get Republicans to stop targeting the military. We got to get Democrats, Biden administration, to stop hiding behind the military. Maybe we also have to get the military to learn how to talk about their values without sounding like culture war combatants. But we got to move to a point where the military is not targeted in these culture wars.
Peter, thanks for joining us. I think we'll have you back to talk about your new book and maybe pick up on that very point.
Well, thank you. I look forward to that chance.
That's Peter Feaver, professor of political science at Duke University. We talked to him today about military readiness as Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama holds up hundreds of promotions and leadership confirmations in protest of a Defense Department policy to support service members seeking abortion care in states where it's still legal. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a guest makes the case that Wisconsin needs to do more to protect election workers from public threats. And some clinics in Wisconsin are using the drug ketamine to try to treat mental health concerns, PTSD, and more. But the practice is still in early days with a lot of questions. A UW researcher joins the show with a look at ketamine. That and more Monday on Central Time.